Welcome to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We have such a great show for you today. So many things to bring you, including a conversation we just finished a few minutes ago with acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey, who entered the race today. We'll be bringing you that conversation shortly, along with an Ask the Doctors. The number there is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have two medical professionals here to answer your coronavirus questions. But we're going to start in the arts and culture world, and I want to ask you to close your eyes for a minute. Close your eyes and try to imagine all the materials, artifacts, letters, housed at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library. Now, did you imagine an archive of materials from Ernest Hemingway? Well, it turns out that you should have. There is a rich store of handwritten letters, typed manuscript drafts, photos, and that helped film directors Ken Burns and Lynn Novick tell a newer, more nuanced story about the author. Their documentary, Hemingway, premieres on PBS this week. Parts 2 and 3 air tonight and tomorrow at 8 p.m. Well, we sat down with Lynn Novick and with Hillary Justice, who is the Hemingway scholar in residence at the JFK Library, who consulted on the film. And I began by asking Lynn why it felt important to re-examine the life of Hemingway now, in 2021, as we go back and question many of our cultural touchstones.
You know, the film is coming out now in 2021, but Ken and I, along with our producer Sarah Botstein and Jeff Ward, our writer, have been working on it for 6 or 7 years. And I personally have been thinking about the idea of a documentary about Hemingway's life and work for more than 25 years. So it is interesting, and just, I'm not sure what to say about the fact that it's coming out in this moment, except that we could not be more pleased about that, because as you say, we are examining our history with a different perspective. We are looking at the icons of the past and, you know, questioning, should this person be on a pedestal? Should this person be erased? Should we still read this writer? Should we still take this art seriously? And Hemingway is right in the middle of that in a very interesting way. And we wanted to make the film because we understand what an important writer he is. He's one of the most important writers in American literature, for sure, and perhaps in world literature. He changed the way people write, and his fingerprints are all over everything to this day, you know, more than 60 years since he passed away. So his legacy is there, but his personal life and the myths around it are very, very problematic.
Hillary, I want to bring you in here. Hemingway was well known or reputed for some things: alcoholism, a kind of Teddy Roosevelt masculinity, being somewhat abusive in his approach to women, struggled with mental illness in his later years. You've really delved into the source materials, gotten to know him. What is our biggest misconception about Ernest Hemingway?
I think the biggest misconception people have about Hemingway doesn't so much have to do with, you know, his writing. I think anyone who reads Hemingway's writing, you can't help but be affected by it. The biggest misconception that people have, though, is his own attitude toward his work, toward his writing. There's a famous mis-saying that flies around the internet every so often, and it's attributed to Hemingway, and it's "write drunk, edit sober." And that is not how he worked. He was such a meticulous wordsmith from the time he was very, very young. He always took his writing very seriously. No detail was too small, but he'd rework it 3 or 4 times, even a single punctuation mark. He'd go back and forth, a comma or a question mark. What had the exact shade of nuance that he was reaching for as a writer? He was perhaps the most disciplined and careful craftsman with words that the 20th century had.
So, you know, I think of Hemingway as belonging to Paris, Spain, Havana. I was surprised to even find he kind of belongs to Michigan after watching the documentary. But we're Radio Boston. The reason we're doing this is that so much of the source material is actually here at the JFK Library. So what is, Hillary, Boston's claim to some piece of the Hemingway legacy? Why is it here?
Well, it's actually here because there were two tragedies back to back in the early 1960s. One of them was Ernest Hemingway's suicide, and one of them was the assassination of President Kennedy. And this left two widows with a responsibility to their husband's legacy. Mary Hemingway was in possession of all of her husband's papers. and their personal photographs collections stretching back, you know, to his parents' photographs in the 1890s. And she was looking for somewhere to place them where they would be cared for and people could access them, and sort of she could ensure the longevity of Hemingway's impact on American culture. So she reached out to Jacqueline Kennedy when she read that Mrs. Kennedy was putting together her husband's presidential library. So the Boston connection is really the Kennedy connection. And then this relationship between these two grieving, powerful women who found themselves doing almost exactly the same thing at exactly the same time. And Mrs. Hemingway reached out to Mrs. Kennedy and said, would you be willing to accept the Ernest Hemingway papers as part of the presidential library? And Mrs. Kennedy wrote back and said she'd be honored.
So Lynn, those materials allow a kind of revealing and a depth of content. In preparing for this, after we had both watched the documentary, our producer Walt Wuthman noticed, he said that you sort of used drafts to create action in the movie, sort of to Hillary's point about how meticulous Hemingway was. I want to play this part of the film. It describes how we can see from these archives that Hemingway rewrote the iconic end to A Farewell to Arms 47 times. So here's the ending where the protagonist, Lieutenant Henry, is facing the death of his lover and their baby, and it's read by Jeff Daniels.
I went to the door of the room. You can't come in now, one of the nurses said. Yes, I can, I said. You can't come in yet. You get out, I said. The other one, too. But after I had got them out and shut the door and turned off the light, it wasn't any good. It was like saying goodbye to a statue. After a while, I went out, left the hospital, and walked back to the hotel in the rain.
Lynn, you hear something like that, and it's so brilliantly read there. You hear the staccato and the short sentiments, right, with all the grief in them. To discover that that was done 47 times, talk about the art of discovery when you have so much material to work with and how it helps you tell a story.
Yeah, well, we really wanted, and we weren't sure how at the beginning of the project, to bring to life how hard Hemingway worked, as Hillary was saying, and to show the process of revision and even starting with a blank piece of paper and writing something down and crossing it out and typing it and crossing it out again. And, you know, in the movies, it's often kind of like the crumpled paper in the wastebasket that's supposed to, you know, represent that. But we really wanted to show it because these words, that's his art. So, you know, you have to literally show it. And we were so grateful that the library and the collection, with Hillary's, you know, direction, helped us find these drafts and pick the ones to show. And then we actually were able to, through digital animation, remove his handwriting from a typewritten page and then put it back on. So you could see the crossing outs and the trying again and playing with the punctuation and changing one word. And just to see the dedication and the kind of trial and error and the process by which he arrived at the beautiful passage we just heard, it took a long time. And that's just one example. I mean, if you could just expand from that to everything he wrote, you can see an artist dedicated to such a degree to getting it right and leaving something indelible.
Hillary, when you walk into the archives, I confess, I almost imagine that you could stand in the middle of the room and hear all these whispers coming up from all the paper. Is that how it feels? And what does it whisper to you?
It is definitely a tremendous feeling of goosebumps. The first time, you know, the research archivist brings you the box and you pull out a folder and you open it and you see these words in Hemingway's handwriting, and it's profound. You know, Hemingway is, in some ways, as a Nobel Prize winner in literature, he's on a pedestal, but you forget that he was a 22-year-old kid writing stories that he didn't know would ever be published. He hoped they'd be published. He hoped he'd be a great writer, but he was just starting out. And so the pages, just what they whisper to me is actually, listen to what they have to say.
Lynn, we are in a time of reckoning in America, especially about race and who tells stories, whose stories get told. Last week, 140 filmmakers signed a letter to PBS criticizing PBS for that lack of diversity, too much reliance on a small set of filmmakers. Mm-hmm. They mentioned Ken Burns. They mentioned this documentary. I want to note they were clear they weren't calling out Burns. They were calling out PBS, who, according to NPR, has said it's going to take a, quote, hard look, end quote, at what they're doing. As someone who has shepherded so many projects forward now, we've talked to you about more than one here. How do you think the industry does a better job telling more and more diverse stories? How do we get 6 hours, say, on a story of Asian American history as advocated, as filmmaker Grace Lee has advocated for? What's the step there?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I just want to say that Ken and I and everyone we work with wholeheartedly concurs with the objectives of the letter and the filmmakers' demands that PBS needs to have more room and be more inclusive and welcome more diverse voices, and that more diverse stories need to be told. That's absolutely true, and that's a positive, important step for our society to take, and it's long overdue. And I also just recognize that there's also forces beyond the world of PBS or the infrastructure ecosystem of PBS that play a part in this, which is access to funding beyond PBS. PBS doesn't actually provide most of our funding, but they do provide important funding for many other filmmakers. It's also promotion. It's also the means of production. You know, there's just systemic entrenched barriers that make it very, very difficult for diverse voices to be heard and to tell their stories. And that's not okay. And we all need to work harder.
All right. In our last couple of minutes, I want to come back to Hemingway and the documentary itself. Lynn, it's 6 hours and there's a lot in there. And one of the things that length of time seems to allow you to do is play with what we think about Hemingway. You dive into his feminine side, his desire even to do role play, his relationship with women. What is something that those who will spend their evenings with this come out of it on the other side saying, you know, wow, I didn't realize?
Well, I don't want to give away too much. I
hope not too much. No, just
watch,
a little.
But yes, but I think we can give away. We can definitely sort of open that door because, you know, the myth of Hemingway and the public persona is so kind of brittle in a way, you know, and it does obscure who he really was, but he wanted it that way. And so once you penetrate through that, you see, and this is partly from his literary work, but also from his private letters and from people around him talking about what he was like. A much more vulnerable, a much more empathic, much more sensitive and sometimes anxious person, and a quiet intellectual who liked to stay home and read books and listen to music. You know, this is not the persona that we think of striding across the African plains, shooting, you know, elephants and buffalo, which he also did with great gusto. So, you know, it's the film, I think we try to kind of both explain who he the persona that he created, and then to peel back the layers so you really get to know him as best as we ever can, someone from the past. And one of the really interesting aspects of his personality and his inner life or intimate life is his masculinity and his relationship to that. And I don't think that in his time, the words that people would have used would be the same as what we would use today to talk about androgyny, gender fluidity, role-playing, as you said, you know, and kind of pushing up against or pushing back against the constraints of the conventional masculine identity. That's really interesting. And it's aspects of his experience and way of thinking about the world and his personal life that was certainly new to us.
Lynn Novick, co-director of Hemingway, and Hilary Justice, the Hemingway Scholar in Residence at the JFK Library. Parts 2 and 3 of the documentary air tonight on PBS and tomorrow night. It is time for Ask the Doctors. We have two medical professionals here to answer your coronavirus and vaccination questions. The number to call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now, Dr. Cassandra Pierre is acting hospital epidemiologist and an infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center. She's also on the faculty at Boston University. Also, Dr. Philip Landrigan, an epidemiologist and pediatrician and director of the Boston College's program in Global Public Health. Doctors Pierre and Landrigan, welcome.
Great to be here.
A pleasure to be here, Tatiana.
Great to have you both. So much to ask, and I know we've got callers who will want to ask questions too. The governor got his first vaccination today at the Heinz Convention Center, first dose earlier this afternoon. He was included in the latest round of eligibility that opened up yesterday, added people over 55 and people over 16 with one health condition. How important is it, Dr. Pierre, for public figures to get the vaccine, to be shown getting it at this stage in our rollout?
I think it's still very important. As every stage of rollout progresses, there will be more people who may have counted on waiting a little bit more time to make their decisions about getting the vaccine. The more people they see fit into the brackets of eligibility who may look like them or have similar age or risk conditions, the better. I know that the governor did make a point to say that he was feeling well. I was glad that he was steady and strong during the conference, basically exhibiting like he's doing well. He got the shot. He's doing well. I really don't think that we can do enough of these. The more that we do this, the more we saturate the airwaves, the more people see people that look like them who are getting these vaccines and are doing well. And that increases acceptance.
Dr. Landergan, we're still in a race against supply, if you will. We have, the state says probably a million more people eligible to be vaccinated as of yesterday. We're hearing some thoughts that given the loosening of restrictions, it may be more than that. We're not there yet on supply. We do know that the federal government and the state government hope we will reach equilibrium. In the meantime, will it scare some people off or suppress some people's willingness to get a vaccine if they try and they can't anytime soon?
Well, I think we're really in a race between the epidemic and getting the vaccine into people's arms. And it's just so incredibly important that everyone who is now eligible gets vaccinated, because every day that a person waits is a day that they're uncovered, and a day when they can catch this terrible disease and then be at risk for passing it on to other people. So I think that the idea that public figures should be vaccinated, sports stars, people that look like people in communities, to break down the barriers, because there's, on the one hand, people are worried about the unknown, which is the fear of the vaccine, which is really extremely safe. And on the other hand, we've got this terrible, terrible disease that kills people and leaves them disabled for months. And it's just very important that everyone in the community speak with the voice of clear reason and cut through the confusion and the misinformation that's being put out.
1-800-423-8255 to ask your coronavirus questions. Dr. Pierre, I'm going to come back to you, and I'm going to delve into an uncomfortable subject. There were new eligibility criteria released over the weekend that made more people qualify for the vaccine. If you are or have been a smoker, if you have a body mass index over a certain level and are considered either overweight or obese, a number of other factors. There has been chatter in social media that what's happening is people who haven't cared as well for their bodies, for example, smokers, are able to get vaccines and healthier people have to wait. On the flip side, the public health messaging is if you have a comorbidity that makes you more vulnerable to serious illness, that has always been our vaccination priority. This doesn't feel like a healthy conversation for us, but it's what's going on out there. How do we sort out the priorities and where we are right now? And what's your response to that tension?
Yeah, there is a lot of tension, also a lot of controversy, not just on the side of people who are saying, well, you know, I've taken care of myself and I'm not eligible, but there's also people who are obesity advocates and activists and who feel stigmatized and potentially marginalized by these new eligibility criteria. And this is a complicated conversation. I guess what I would say is we know that BMI is not necessarily the ultimate arbiter of health, but it is a useful indicator. We know that those who have been noted to be obese do have worse outcomes with COVID-19. The mere fact of being obese is not a personal choice in many circumstances, and in fact, probably most. We think about underserved communities that have been systemically marginalized, who have had poor access to healthcare, healthy food, or safe spaces in which they can exercise. There's so many factors that add up to obesity that may be, and certain circumstances are definitely beyond personal control. So in terms of anti-obesity bias, we need to move beyond that. The people who are at higher risk need to get vaccinated because they are at higher risk for severe complications of COVID and death. And yes, we want everyone, as Dr. Landergren mentioned, to get vaccinated as soon as possible. This is a race against time locally, nationally, and globally. But the prioritization has been put into place to protect those who have higher risk of either severe outcomes of COVID or higher risk of exposure. And so we really need to put that aside and start focusing on trying to get people as vaccinated as quickly as possible, regardless of the indication for their vaccination.
Let's grab a call here quickly. Joan in Cambridge. Joan, what's your question?
Good afternoon. My question is this. I have had both of my vaccines. I've waited the 2 weeks after the second. And I'm going to celebrate the birthday of a friend of mine who is 95 years old, and she is living in a very secure senior residency. I've just had a COVID test just to make sure that I don't infect her. And my question is, is this really necessary? She has also had her both of her vaccines some time ago. She's, as I say, 95. We'll be
Joan,
95.
Is what necessary? Is masking necessary? Is that what you're asking?
No. I, having gone through all of my vaccines, and she's gone through all her vaccines, the question is it really necessary? I've just lined up to take a COVID test to make sure that I don't infect her. But is that really necessary?
I mean,
is it possible that I can infect her?
Thank you, Joan. Dr. Landergren.
I would say it's a situation of belt and suspenders. You're really going all the way in terms of being cautious. And I think that's appropriate in dealing with somebody who's 95 years old. In reality, what's the likelihood that you're going to spread it to her? Minuscule. But she's a dear friend. She's very old. Why not go the extra step as you have?
Thanks, Dr. Landergren. Let's get one more question here. Paul in Marshfield. Paul, briefly, what's your question?
How effective, thanks so much, Doctor. How effective is the J&J when they say it's like 72% effective? Like, what does that mean? And should I wait for a Moderna or just get it because I can get it tomorrow?
Thanks, Paul, and glad to hear you've got the opportunity. Dr. Pierre.
Paul, kudos on the opportunity. That is very confusing in terms of what we hear when we talk about effectiveness against any infection. That 72% is an indication of how effective the J&J has been in the United States in preventing any symptomatic COVID disease. But what we've actually been looking at, what we think is actually most important, is the fact that J&J, Moderna, and Pfizer all protect us 100% against the severe forms of COVID, so hospitalization and death. The other thing that's important to know is that 72% was not compared to Moderna or Pfizer and Pfizer in head-to-head studies, and so we actually don't know what the relative efficacy of that vaccine is. In fact, we think it's probably a little bit higher in the real-world situation. But the bottom line is that it is very important. It will protect you. It will reduce your risk of symptomatic infection and potentially eliminate your risk of severe disease or hospitalization. As our numbers are rising in the state, I do recommend that people take the first approved vaccine that is made available to them.
And Dr. Landergren, we have very limited time left, but as a pediatrician, I want to ask you, where does the research stand on the potential efficacy and safety of the vaccines for children under 16?
Well, we now know that the vaccine is safe and highly effective for adolescents. And I think we'll have a very clear statement on safety for young children very shortly. But my presupposition is that it will be very safe for children. To be sure, most children who get COVID do pretty well with it, but there's a small subset who don't do well, and therefore protecting children will be very, very important.
And Dr. Pierre, in a sentence, how concerned should we be about the variants right now?
Well, middlingly, we know. In a sentence, they are something that is on the horizon. The vaccine should protect us from most of those variants, especially the quicker we get our population vaccinated. And so this is something that will be less of a concern the more of us are vaccinated.
That is Dr. Cassandra Pierre, acting hospital epidemiologist and infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center, and Dr. Philip Landergren, an epidemiologist and pediatrician and director of the Boston College Program on Global Public Health. Thanks so much to you both. Really appreciate the time today.
Most welcome.
It's official. Acting Mayor Kim Janey is running. She is running for mayor of Boston. Here she is talking about her priorities while making the announcement at a press conference earlier today.
Racial equity, economic equity have always been central to all of my work long before I ran for public office, and that will continue as mayor.
We caught up with Kim Janey just a few minutes before the show on her way to East Boston, and I started by asking her to make her case to voters just 2 weeks into her time as acting mayor.
One, I just want to say I think there are amazing people in this race. I know and have worked with many of them, and I think it is a great field of candidates, blessed to be among them. You know, as someone who grew up in the city, this is a city that I love, the city that nurtured me, that helped shape me, along with my family and my community. And I bring my lived experience as someone who grew up in the city and faced many of the challenges that our residents are facing now. And I know that we need to come out of this pandemic as mayor. That is my first priority, making sure that we are focused on the public health crisis, that we are focused on recovery, reopening, and renewal, ensuring the equitable distribution of the vaccine so that we can reopen our city fully and get people back to work, get our kids back in school. We know that there are so many challenges that predate COVID-19. And to really tackle these problems, these challenges that are persistent, that have been with us, and that have been years, decades, centuries in the making, will take more than a few months. It'll take hard work. It'll take bold leadership. It will take, residents coming together to do this work. And so I'm encouraged by the outpouring of support and look forward to continuing to work with residents, work with our community partners, work with everyone who wants to come out of this pandemic a stronger Boston, a more resilient Boston, and a more equitable Boston. This, again, is a great city, and we got to make sure that Boston works for everyone.
So you have an added platform as a candidate, being acting mayor, coming from the mayor's office. That also means increased scrutiny. For example, the issue of leadership at the Boston Police Department. Your predecessor, Mayor Walsh, named Dennis White the new commissioner. He was quickly placed on leave after allegations of domestic abuse became public. Yesterday, Boston Herald columnist Joe Battenfeld wrote, quote, "Janey should be pressing the department to release every internal affairs document there is on White. That's real police accountability, which is what Janey has promised," end quote. I want to give you a chance to respond to that. Are you pressuring the BPD to update the public on its investigation?
Well, right now, this is under an investigation, an independent investigation, and I want to let that investigation play out so that I can have all of the information to make an informed decision about the leadership of our police force. I do want to note that, there is Superintendent Long in the position as interim commissioner, and I've been working closely with him around many of the challenges that we all face together. We're working together to think about how we reimagine policing more broadly, and obviously the implementation of the Office of Police Accountability and Transparency is central to that work. We'll be announcing an executive director for that work and look forward to working with the police department. But until this investigation is complete, not ready to make a decision yet on the leadership.
So let's talk about education, which is something you've talked a good deal about. You know, your first day sworn in as acting mayor of Boston, you went to your formal middle school. Later, you participated in the Metco program after being a part of busing. We are in such a complex time in education in Boston now, with students returning to school, the logistical challenges of COVID, and long-term issues. What is the core issue in education for you as a mayoral candidate?
You know, for me, it continues to be equity. It is something that I promoted in my career before entering public office, you know, equity in education and making sure that we are laser-like focused on the elimination of the opportunity and achievement gaps that persist for far too long for too many of our students. The vast majority of our students are students of color, often living in poor communities of color, not having access to the same opportunities. And it is important that we recognize that and that we're intentional in closing those gaps. And I know that is the work that our superintendent is focused on and our educators as well. But we also know that remote learning has been a challenge, that it's been difficult for families to connect online, and difficult for our educators as well. We've got a lot of work to do to deal with this pandemic. And prior to the pandemic, you know, there were the opportunity achievement gaps. And now with COVID, we know that things have only worsened. And so really important that we focus on making up for lost learning time, and that we as a city come together, you know, not just our public schools, but how do we engage our business community? How do we engage the faith community? How do we engage, you know, institutions of higher ed and the medical institutions and the cultural institutions in this work to really wrap their arms around our young people and provide supports, especially in the summer, through summer learning opportunities, but really year-round.
So let's talk about the race for a moment. I think we could say that this is the six major candidates in the race are a progressive slate of candidates. Do you see any major specific political differences between you and the other major candidates in the race?
You know, as mayor and throughout my entire career, I have been focused on equity. You know, I have a clear track record doing this work. In terms of, you know, comparing different candidates, I will leave that to that kind of commentary to the political pundits. But I think, you know, my record is pretty clear. I will continue to lead with a racial equity lens, a lens around justice and around love, and one that seeks to bring our residents together to tackle these challenges together.
What does it mean to lead with love?
You know, it has been such a difficult time in our city. And one thing that has been so encouraging as we've been battling this pandemic is to see the way residents have come together to support each other. And I know it is frustrating for folks, and it's been just devastating every one of us. You know, regardless of race or zip code or income, know someone who has died from COVID, someone who has, you know, fell ill to COVID, someone who's recovered from COVID, someone who has potentially lost a job or housing due to this pandemic. And again, we know that the challenges, you know, predate COVID, but COVID has really shown a light and has exacerbated pre-existing inequities. But the spirit of Boston is a city that when things are tough, you know, residents come together to support each other. And we've seen that. And, you know, launching the HOPE campaign today and the all-inclusive campaign yesterday and really focused on tapping into our collective joy and resiliency as a city, I think is so important.
And we will close it there. That is Acting Mayor and now mayoral candidate Kim Janey. Acting Mayor Janey, thanks so much for the time today. I hope you'll join us again soon.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Have a wonderful, blessed day.
For our final segment today, we're going to revisit a conversation with Brooklyn-based artist Sean Leonardo about his exhibit, The Breath of Empty Space, which was on display at Mass MoCA last October through December. In his work, Leonardo uses manipulated charcoal drawings to reinterpret images of Black and brown men and boys who have been victims of police violence. The drawings include representations of widely shared images showing the beating of Rodney King, the body of Michael Brown, and others. It is not meant to be comfortable viewing, and the exhibit didn't come to North Adams without controversy. It was meant to go to Cleveland's Contemporary Art Museum. But that showing was canceled after Black activists and museum staff objected to the work, saying it would be traumatizing for the community. One of the activists who objected was the mother of Tamir Rice, whose image is used in the work. That experience reinvigorated Leonardo's commitment to what he sees as the necessity of his art, when we spoke to him, I started by asking him about the impetus for this work.
Well, the first drawing in the series actually followed nearly a year after the killing of Trayvon Martin. And I will be entirely honest with you, when I first started working with this material, it was for no one other than myself. I needed to find a way to be able to look into Trayvon's eyes without any of the media distraction, without any of the accompanying noise. I wanted to just be able to grapple with the fear that was emerging in my body, in my psyche, knowing that someone as young as Trayvon, that his life could be so easily taken away. And so much of what I had clearly buried from my own upbringing had come surging back, particularly because it was at a time when my wife and I were considering having a child. And so I looked at Trayvon and understood that that fear would have to be transferred over to whomever I brought into this world.
So this brings up one of the things that was on my mind in looking at the images of the artwork and of the exhibit itself. The exhibit itself is this long hallway, which looks, it looks like a gauntlet, like this long gauntlet that you walk. And the images run down this gauntlet, and we often have a narrative of each one of these as an instance. The George Floyd killing, the Trayvon Martin killing, the Tamir Rice killing. But in fact, it's a story of history. These aren't moments. This is an arc of a story that not only was playing out when you did the art, but played out violently and repeatedly in the months since the exhibit went in. Does the exhibit have a different feel to you now after this summer? And do you want people to walk this gauntlet of history of violence?
Absolutely. I think that was intentional. And I would say it feels different in the moment, of course, that where we find ourselves in the ways that it feels ever more so charged and more present in our lives. But it depicts a historical legacy of this violence. And much of what you see is the ways in which it is not contained to police violence out in the streets, but that it plays out in the courts, as is conveyed in the work with the Central Park Five incident. And what I hope for is that we have to better understand the systemic reasons behind these moments, these tragedies, that they are interconnected. And what I'm asking the viewer then is to understand how they might be complacent in their looking in the ways in which it becomes a flash of emotion for some of us, but then subsides. And that to enact real social change, it requires us to look deeply and read carefully into the ways that they are interconnected, so that we understand that there are specific systems, structures that uphold violence or the ways that violence can be enacted against Black and brown bodies.
I want to move now into some of the controversy around this exhibit, The Breath of Empty Space. It's at Mass MoCA after the Contemporary Art Museum in Cleveland canceled it, after a group of local Black activists and museum staff in the city objected to the work. There are a number of issues in that. I think the thing I want to ask you about to start is when one shows images of someone's violence and trauma, it raises questions, I think, two that I'd love to hear you reflect on. The first is, how does one have to be careful in the way of presenting those images to make sure that we're not touring someone else's trauma? And then two, how do we decide who owns those images and can use them?
And that's an absolutely incredibly important debate and valid question. And I think they are interrelated. So I will actually answer those in the opposite way than what you asked them. I would like to propose that there is a way in which, if we are asked to collectively absorb these images and the ways in which they are circulated and such so widely disseminated and then repeated in the media that it is a collective trauma as well. And so the question of ownership, I of course, is a sensitive one, but I also like to pose alongside that, that it's a question of responsibility. Who's responsible to these images? And so to your first question, I'd like to make the distinction between a representation of the images as we receive them from the media and a work of art that offers a different type of opportunity of sitting with the image and processing it in such a way that one might gather more meaning and one might actually find an opening toward healing. And that's a very different proposition. And I agree, the ways in which proximity to any of these images, context around these images, our responsibility, the ways in which it is being presented and hosted, all of those things lead to a worthy debate in terms of how any of my work and any other work that deals with and works through traumatic imagery, how it should exist in the world. But my point of view is that the art should be at the center of that debate. And so the very last thing we should do is cancel out the work, because it is the work that will lead the path toward the healing. And we will not be able to find that space unless we engage these the trauma directly, and unless we hold on to it, engage it, and grapple with it.
So how do you, and I understand you work with an independent curator, John Chaish, how do the two of you engage with museums, which are historically white-funded, white-run, and too often made comfortable and available to white communities and not communities of color? In situating the exhibit, in engaging with community on it, I'm assuming, I believe, there must be some way that you believe that part must be done in order to ensure that people sit with the discomfort of these images in the way that you feel they must.
Absolutely. And what it requires is a real felt relationship with the individuals that make up the institution. We often forget that in these systems, these institutions, that they are made up of people. It's assessing the willingness and openness and engaging in difficult conversations, not solely as a museum, but as the individuals within the museum. And therefore, finding ways for the staff and leadership to move closer to the work. And that is as much part of what is being described as community engagement as any outreach effort. And so plotting ahead with John, the independent curator, and developing a relationship of trust is crucial in creating a space of care and accountability to Black and Brown audiences, BIPOC audiences, because if those within it are not able to see themselves and implicate their own whiteness in their seeing, then they will attempt to remove themselves from the work. And it's always been important to me that they become part of the process in engagement. And I think that is ultimately what failed in Cleveland, that they enacted a process without me, without my voice.
Why do you feel that Mass MoCA and North Adams are prepared to engage with and embrace this exhibit? And why are you comfortable that the experience you're seeking, that people will have it this time around?
I think it's important to acknowledge that my relationship with Mass MoCA has started years ago. And so it stems from that relationship. It stems from that openness and willingness to engage the work and the necessary difficulty in bringing people in with care. And so it didn't really come as so much of a surprise that they were able to step up and willing to step up in such a heartfelt way. And so the negotiation, if I'm going to call it that, actually occurred rather quickly because there was already a foundational trust there and ways in which they have been working to expand themselves out into the nearby communities and invite the tension in. And that is what this work deserves.
You said a few minutes ago, Sean, that you wanted to ensure that people would not remove themselves from the art. One of the things that is most striking to me in looking at the art is that you have removed things from the pictures. There are 6 pictures of Michael Brown under a shroud, but in, I think it's 2 of them, his body's gone. In the Central Park 5, it's a court drawing, but we only see pieces of it. The Rodney King drawing is so haunting because the police, and you can see them in physical action, but the space where Rodney King would be is a white void. Why remove pieces of the moment? What is the thought there?
So it goes back to this original notion that I proposed, that there is the difference between representing the image as we once saw it and utilizing the image toward a different kind of opportunity. And I think it's in these various strategies that you're describing, which can only be really felt and seen when you're in the physical space, that implicates our looking differently. And so, for example, the Rodney King drawing is a perfect example in which we are so ingrained with the image of that beaten black body that so often we miss the fact that there were 11 officers at that scene. There's a relationship, a direct correlation between what survives in our collective consciousness and the choices by the media. And what I'm asking viewers to see is their own complacency in what they receive and what and how we remember.
My last question for you, Sean, in just a few words, what conversation would you want people to have when they leave the exhibit?
I want this exhibition, this work, to show us that we can internalize these images differently and that it can have an impact on how we conduct ourselves every day with one another. Whether that moves us toward activism or some other kind of action, what I'm saying is that there's a direct determination in the way we look and the way we act and the way we bring meaning to this history of violence. So I want people to have a moment of self-introspection, to understand where they sit today in 2020 and the change that is being called upon for all of us. And it starts by the way that we look at each other and perceive each other's identities.
That was artist Sean Leonardo talking about his exhibit, The Breath of Empty Space, which was on display at MassMoCA last October through December.